Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, my interview with novelist Marlon James. His new novel, Black Leopard, Red Wolf, is one of the huge hits of the winter. It swirls fantasy and African storytelling and delicious mythology into an epic tale. And Marlon James is just a terrific interview. When we sat down on the stage of the Fitz, I was interested in how he slipped so effortlessly into a mythical world.
You know, I think growing up in Jamaica, sometimes real and surreal gets blurred.
How so?
I remember once, this was a funeral. We were there for a funeral, and my aunt wakes up and she says has this dream of this pillow flying, and she doesn't know what. It freaked her out. And I was like, it's really a dream. And then I looked up and there was a pillow in the air.
What?
And I was like, so I don't know if we shared a dream or if it was actually up in the air or somebody heard her and threw a pillow up to freak both of us out. But it's, you know, it's like what Marquez says about the Caribbean. You know, the Caribbean, the reality in the Caribbean is crazier than the wildest fiction. That's why he always objected to the magical realist tag.
He's right.
Like, no, this is reality. Yes, right. It did rain frogs last week.
Right.
Yeah.
You were reading Gabriel Garcia Marquez, what, as a kid?
I was reading him in college. I read him by accident, meaning I stole the book. Well, the previous class, a student accidentally left it behind.
Yeah.
I am seeing this book called 100 Years of Solitude,
right.
And it had this great cover. And I was like, well, since if nobody's using it. You know, in Jamaica, we have this saying, what stay too long, serve two masters. So it was there too long. It found another master. And I went home, and it completely changed my life. So thank you, whoever I stole that book from.
How else does that saying apply? Did you say what stays too long serves two masters?
Where does that apply to?
Yeah.
Like if you have food out too long, and you come back, and it's gone. You should have ate it. You should have eaten it.
Right. So you're reading Marquez mm-hmm. in college.
Yeah.
You said.
I'm reading him accidentally because I'm doing English Lit, so Marquez wouldn't have been on the syllabus. He would have been on the comparative literature or Hispanic Lit class. So my guess is that the person who left it was cheating because she was supposed to read Marquez in Spanish. So they probably snuck into English. So I did that student a favor, I think.
Right.
Because, you know, you cheat. It reminds me of another Jamaican proverb. We said, like, you know, you cheat a cheat, God laughs.
Again?
Or you steal from a thief, God laughs.
Ah.
So I think I was a force for good that day.
Yeah.
I think so.
I was thinking about the commonality mm-hmm. of mythology across a lot of different cultures and
right.
how the idea of the quest mm-hmm. is so central
yeah.
to different mythologies, different myths. And the idea that the quest is about not just getting to the end and mm-hmm. being transformed somehow, mm-hmm. but also that process of illumination along mm-hmm. the way.
Yeah, it's the one thing they tend to all have in common, whether it's the Odyssey or Journey to the West, is that it's the journey that's really important.
Exactly.
The destination is great, but more often than not, the destination is a deliberate anticlimax. The real lessons and the really important turn of events happens on the journey, and the really important changes happen on the journey, and the things you learn happen in the process of getting there. And you're right, that's one thing that almost all these myths, all these legends have in common.
Even if you think about the Canterbury Tales, if you think mm-hmm. about the Greek mythology.
Yeah, definitely with the Greek.
It's it's, I think you plunge into this kind of experience of reading this mythology, thinking it really is about getting to the end, about getting to the destination.
Yeah. And the fact that you never actually get there,
right?
Becomes important, or that you may never get there. Or sometimes when you get there, it's not what you think. It's not what you thought it would have been.
How are you thinking about that as you conceived the beginning of this trilogy?
It helps that I already knew the ending. The kid's dead. Spoiler. Sorry.
I promised these people there would be no spoilers.
It's the first line in the book. So knowing that already, I knew it would have been a why done it, as opposed to a who done it.
Right.
I knew it would be how did we get to this point. I really admire that John Irving always begins his novels with the end.
Oh my gosh, we were just talking about John Irving in the audience. Huh. Yeah.
Psychic.
You're right. He writes the last line, which is so weird.
I don't do that because my thoughts are nowhere as together as his. But I do think that how did we get to this point is a fascinating story. Because it not just because it sends you backwards, but it sends you rendering how, I tell my students, I don't want to know why your couple is getting a divorce. I want to see how the marriage fell apart. And I think it's not even a why, it's a rendering how that becomes really, really interesting and exciting. You have to allow, though, that things may change and go beyond what you intend. And all my novels happen that way. No novel ends the way I thought it would. They didn't even have the middle that I thought they would. In fact, most often than not, that's not the character I wanted to tell, whose story I wanted to tell.
At what point did that happen?
With this, so Tracker showed up, the very first draft I wrote of this, or the very first set of pages I wrote of this, Tracker was a minor character, and I wrote 20 pages, and I was very happy, because I wrote 20, and I went, that is not what I want to write. and I was, it's part of the process. I remember my second novel, the character who ends up being the main character in the story was a woman working in a bar, and I just wondered what was her story. And in following her, completely driving my entire novel off course, I couldn't stop following her, and I couldn't stop, really digging into her story. And I remember, because I was doing it for my MFA, and I'd have these arguments and these sort of crises with my workshop director. I'm like, she's taken over my book. And it's like, well, you have to let them take over the book. I said, no, it's my book. Yeah, it's my novel. So, no, I just let them run rampant and do whatever they want.
This is why I've always thought that John Irving thing is so weird, because there is a destination point that is already set. And so whatever is happening along the way really does have a kind of destiny to it, right?
Yeah.
He knows where this is going.
Yeah.
How serendipitous can it be when he knows that it's all going... Yeah, go ahead.
But then I think of nonfiction, though, because nonfiction, more often than not, you know the outcome, and yet you're still caught up in suspense reading it. Clearly the person survived. They're writing the book.
Yes.
But that doesn't kill the drama at all. So I do think even with him sort of knowing how it ends, I think the twists and turns, I think it might be even... an extra challenge for him. How do I make this seem as if it wasn't just fatalistic? That characters actually had choices, but look at how they ended up.
Maybe it is fatalistic.
I don't know. I think we can look at any story in reverse and see the choices that led to it. If some of my students are in the audience, and they may very well get this as an assignment. If I give them an inevitable ending, I'll say, get me to the ending where I knew there were other options possible.
What does that mean?
Meaning that even though an ending is what it is, it's choices that led to it. Sometimes it's mistakes that led to it. Sometimes it's you underestimating what the consequences of your actions would be that led to it. So I think you can sort of write a novel in reverse and still have that sense of anything could happen. I am not doing it, but it could happen.
So do you reverse engineer a lot of the reading, the novels that you read? And how many stand up to the standard that you apply to your students? Like, anything could have happened.
Mm-hmm. Most of the ones that I end up finishing do. I finish a handful of novels. I start 200.
Wow. You're one of those people who isn't afraid to let it go.
Yeah,
I admire people like you.
No, I had to, or I would grow crazy. Or I just read really short books. I read two really great novels in a row recently. My Sister, the Serial Killer.
Ah.
And
Boyanka Braithwaite. Yeah. So good.
Yeah, and The Perfect Nanny.
Oh, I haven't read that yet.
The problem with The Perfect Nanny is called Lullaby in Europe. And the problem with The Perfect Nanny is the type of reader who reads a book called The Perfect Nanny, picks it up, and nobody recovers from the first paragraph.
Really? Oh,
It's interesting hearing people, I couldn't get past the first page. I'm like, yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about My Sister, the Serial Killer, because
yes.
This is fun. So if you reverse engineer that novel, how many really different ways could that have gone? For me, it feels like it kind of had to go where it was, where it went. I won't spoil it for you guys, but you read the novel. It's outstanding.
The thing is, though, I still felt up to the end that the sister had choices. And a couple of times, if it had ended in a way she actually acted on one of those, I'd have still believed it. I think, funny enough, the fatalism in that novel is actually the sisters. It's not the novels. It's the sisters.
Right.
And that's a choice. You know, she could easily have said, enough is enough, or this one backfired, or I don't want to spoil it too much because you really should read the book.
Yeah.
After you buy mine.
They did. They're all sitting there with a copy on their laps.
But I wouldn't have liked it. I wouldn't have liked it. I that's one of the things I must be convinced of when I read a novel. That these are human beings and they had choices and they had agency. And you can be caught up in a moment and you can be caught up in things that aren't beyond your control. But I still want to know that you have the capacity for change, even if you don't, or even if you change for the worse.
Uh-huh. Well, a few minutes ago, I think you said, this is the challenge I give to my students when writing, even though I'm not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't you say that?
I have them play by a lot of rules I break.
Okay, so why do you break that rule a lot?
No, because I know I'm in a zone when these characters become people. And they start to do things people do that we don't expect.
Such as
surprise us. I don't know necessarily specifically what. I just think the characters become real when they do things like disappoint us. So when characters surprise us, when characters disappoint us, to me, that's when they start being real. Because I certainly don't go in the world expecting my friends to disappoint me.
But they do. And you know who you are.
But I don't go in with that view of my friends, so it always hits me off guard. But I think when characters become people, they have to start doing those things, like surprise you and disappoint you. I'm disappointed in my characters all the time.
Are you?
Oh, yeah. I expect better.
Specifically, how are your characters disappointing you?
Because they're so real. They should be always virtuous, and they should do what I want.
Ah. But virtuousness is often really boring.
It is really boring.
Disappointment is interesting, right? Isn't that what you're saying?
Yeah, it is interesting. It is interesting writing characters who do disappointing or terrible things to other people. But I'm also a big believer when you write those things that there should be consequences and it shouldn't just be something that just happens.
Mm-hmm.
I like writing how characters deal with the consequences of their actions.
How do you make sure that the consequences don't feel kind of pro forma expected? Mm-hmm. Because that's kind of dull, too.
Yeah, but even that has to be kind of disappointing, I think. I think
the consequences.
Because I think
meaning what though?
Meaning that when characters, for example, get way too convenient at comeuppance, you know, most of the people who have done me wrong are living quite fine lives, and that karma I'm waiting on just not doesn't seem to be happening.
Yeah.
So I have to remember that with my characters. I think I remember watching one of the seasons of Game of Thrones, and where one of the Stark sisters finally gets her revenge on this guy who brutalized her.
And it takes a long time.
Right. But I thought this is a little too much wish fulfillment. Like, revenge doesn't really work that way. You know, usually, even if you get revenge, it's kind of hollow.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Because really, the character growth. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is, what are you doing with the fact that you have not been vindicated, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that where the interest is in the character?
Yeah, and that even when you are vindicated, it's kind of hollow.
Right.
It's kind of, it's not quite the reward you were expecting.
Right.
And I think, and I those are the things I actually like writing. It's things I hate experiencing, but I do like writing them.
Sometimes I think... we've become a reading public that requires the kind of formulaic comeuppance. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Ambivalence about that is just like kind of in our media, just in the kind of the environment that we live in, right?
Yeah.
Ambivalence is uncomfortable.
It is. And I think we are reassured when people get their just desserts.
Right. But they don't often get
that. They don't often. I remember being horrified by the ending of Chinatown. I was like, really? This is how it's going to end? He gets another one? And then I write endings like that. It's got one laugh. That's my friend.
And you write endings like that because?
Well, I don't know. For lots of reasons. One, it's sometimes a wink at a reader. But I also think it's sometimes that life just doesn't work that way. And I think that kind of sort of wish fulfillment revenge thing, it can be a pleasure. But there's some part of it where you're going to realize that this is not quite how life works. And this is not quite the things we have to deal with. And even when that happens, it's not always what it was meant to be. Because ultimately, it's still a pretty hollow, dark thing, revenge.
You went back to read Beowulf, is that right, in preparation for this?
Mm-hmm.
I have clear memories of being taught Beowulf in college. And by a teacher who declaimed the whole thing. Mm-hmm. How did you first read it or experience
it? Well, Beowulf is one of those stories I've always experienced on my own. I never read it in a class.
Really?
And the first time I read Beowulf was actually a comic. It was actually a graphic novel. It was actually really good. I'm getting all these little claps today. And then I read Seamus Heaney's translation, and then I read Tolkien's. I'm not going to say whose I like more.
Come on, say.
Okay, I do like Heaney's more.
Why?
Because I think that all the ancient epics do stand as great poetry. And I can tell when an epic hasn't been translated by a poet yet.
Oh, wow. How?
Just the misunderstanding of rhythm and prosody and understanding that these things were to be spoken aloud. And if you're going to speak aloud, it has to be music. Like, there's a new translation. It's not new anymore. It was translated at least 15 years ago of the Torah. And there's a line in the Bible that says, "From the dust came Adam." And he changed it and put, "From the humus came the human," which completely changed everything because it's Robert Alter, I think. He remembers that these old stories are written to be spoken. And that's something I thought of when I was writing this book, that it has to be able, you have to be able to read it aloud. because that's how all the ancient stories were.
How well do you know the Bible?
I know it pretty well.
Do you?
Yeah.
Why?
Because I was a Christian for a few years. Okay, more than a few.
But I was raised Christian, yeah. Lutheran. I don't know the Bible. I couldn't even spew out a verse you just did.
But I joined church when I was like 28 because I was running away from the gay.
Right.
And it was a great place to run away from the gay. Me and all the other gay guys in church. You know? Talking.
All right. So
I got to know it very well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you memorized. I mean, was part of that experience of church and coming to church as an adult really understanding and memorizing the poetry of the Bible?
And you do it because you think you're making up for lost time. Because if you didn't grow up in church, and like me, you're trying to escape the gay. I was sucking up everything. I was at Sunday service. I was at Monday Bible study. I was at Wednesday church. I was at Thursday prayer group. I was at Friday teens meeting. I'm not a teen, so
this
that was kind of creepy.
Really? Wow. This is at 28.
This was
years
28
old.
Till I think I finished my first novel. So I was there for a while.
So what brought you to church?
Mm-hmm.
You said to escape the gay.
Yeah.
It was an identity crisis, as in, how am I going?
Yeah. You know, I'm trying to think of all the reasons why, but mostly I just didn't want to be a gay man. Mm-hmm. And I've always heard Jesus solves all problems. And I remember I went and got the whole, "Are you gay? No way" pamphlet.
Were they giving that out at the church?
No, I had to get it mail order.
Ah.
And yeah, and it's shipped in a little paper bag, and it was like, "Are you gay?"
Who creates that kind of stuff?
Well, but it's a huge thing. Jared Cardinley talks about it in Boy Erased, the ex-gay movement and Exodus Ministries, which is still pretty prominent in Jamaica. And that, yeah, it's still, a lot of those things are still going strong because you're, you know, especially the way I was raised. I mean, I always thought there is no way I'm going to keep my family and be myself. So let's get rid of myself. And, you know, in church, you can sort of throw yourself in it. It was fascinating being around the other church gays. You know,
what was it like?
It was weird. Like one person asked, "So how are you?" And he'd be like, "I had just a smashing, wonderful, intimate time in the Lord." And I'd go to my pastor and I go, "You know, I think Tim loves Jesus." And he's like, "We all need to love the Lord, my child." I'm like, "No, I think he loves Jesus."
So did you feel like that you were going to be converted through the church? Or did you think, this will be so subsuming, so consuming, this experience with the church, that I will no longer have these urges or desires?
That is exactly what they say. You sure you weren't in church?
Do they say that?
That's exactly how they put it. Because they'll go, if you go to become straight, you will never succeed. But if you search for the love that passes all love, then all those little things. It's like trickle-down economics. Those little things. Okay, that's an unfortunate choice of image. But it will just eventually sort itself out. It was really strange.
Did you believe that going in?
I absolutely believed it.
You did?
Well, I wanted to believe it. And I think that's it. And I remember, funny enough, when I did the math on this stage, I was saying, it's not even that I believed it, it's that I wanted to believe it so badly. And I think wanting to believe can be almost as strong as belief.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was it. I just worked so hard to believe it.
So at what point... I think you said you were involved with the church for what, 6-7
More
years?
Than that. Yeah.
More than that?
Yeah, maybe like 6-7.
So
seven.
At what point did you have to say, it's not working?
Well, What point? I think there's a cycle you go on, which is like temptation, sin, confession, repentance, purity, temptation, sin, confession, blah, blah, blah. And I kept trying to get rid of all those things, which is funny. I wasn't really sinning, but that's a lie. I kept trying to get rid of all these parts of the cycle, and the cycle couldn't stop. And one day I went, what if I get rid of church? And that worked wonderfully. It is funny because there's so much about me that's still church. It's still, you know, like I tell people, you know, I'd rather have joy than happiness, which is so church. You know, people around me said, I'm worried about this. I'm like, don't worry, worrying is sinful meditation. And I go, oh yeah, from church.
Wow.
But I still believe
it. It's deep, right?
I still believe it. I still don't believe in worry. I actually think worrying is a sin.
Did you have to go to your pastor and tell him that you'd reach this point where what you'd come to the church for was not going to happen and you were going to have to leave the community?
No, because he had a stroke. That's not funny. Okay, it's a little funny.
Was there anybody that you had to tell in that church faith community?
Not really. I kind of took French leave of the church. I think which is leave without saying goodbye. So I kind of took French leave of the church. But I was also drifting away because of the novel I wrote. And I knew the first novel, which is about all sorts of religious crises and dysfunctional religion, wouldn't have gone very well. And I knew that being a writer and writing about these things was what I wanted to do.
So did it mean that the experience of drifting away gave rise to having to create this novel about it? Or was in the process of creating the novel, you really identified
The novel that started the drift.
Really?
Yeah. It was a process of writing that novel and the process of actually becoming a writer. That if you're going to become a novelist, if you're going to be a writer, and it doesn't matter the genre, easy answers aren't going to get you very far. And the church I was in was all about easy answers. So I knew this is something was already, a schism was already happening, because I was drawing myself to way more complicated things than a line or an aphorism can answer. And I knew that it was gonna come to a head at some point. And I also knew that the trajectory that I was going on, where you're a devout Christian, you devote your life to it. People go, how come he doesn't have a wife? You go, well, he's all about Jesus. You know, and I become like my other friends were like, you know, I'm just waiting for the Lord to shine the light of a wife in my life.
You know, I have to imagine, though, that in drifting away, you were leaving big holes in your life. I mean, you were there on Wednesdays and Sundays, and this was, you were deeply embedded in this community.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you adjust to that?
You don't. I had a pretty fortunate series of events. My book came out. I left the church. I sold my other book. I got this job at McAllister to come for a year. I've been here a little more than a year. And a series of events really sort of swept me up. But even so, you're right, there are all these voids in my life. You can fill so much with work. And with writing, that's one of the reasons why I used to get these serious depressions when I was finished with a book. Because I'd be, but now I have to live life, and I don't do that very well. What do I do? I know, I'll write another book.
You said used to. That doesn't happen anymore?
No, well, no, because, you know, I have friends now and significant others. Well, one, not others.
I was about to pounce on that.
Nah. I think a richer and more abundant life. And there's certainly more to writing than writing. It certainly helps the writing if there's more to writing than than writing.
You know, it kind of brings us back to where we started when I was telling that story about feeling like I'd kind of slipped into a story or a myth. I mean, do you must have had that experience and maybe some of that reluctance of the book is over, now I'm back to real life is moving back and forth in that dimension and feeling like this side of the dimension is never going to be as satisfying or exhilarating as that side of the dimension. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I don't know if I feel that way, though, because I look for different things in each. I don't think my characters in my books are the type of people who will find just an evening drinking wine with a friend satisfying. They're like, who are we going to kill today? What are we going to hunt?
That is so true.
Whereas I don't have those kind of habits. I live for and appreciate different things. I also the worlds I write are for me full of wonder, but also full of danger. Hmm. Like, I've never written a place where I'd rather be.
Oh.
Even though I quite like the worlds that I write, I'm like, no, I don't live there. I can barely survive 4 hours without electricity. What do you mean, no internet? Like, no.
Why do you think danger is such an essential part of the worlds that you're writing?
I think because it's an essential part of every world. I mean, if you even Aristotle's Poetics is basically saying trouble is interesting. I think, for me, I still get a thrill from seeing how do people get themselves out of the messes they're in. And it's something I still like writing. It's something I like figuring out. And it's something I like reading. I think we just love seeing it. We like seeing how people deal and get out of trouble. And as a writer, I still write in a way. One of the ways in which I write is to sort of put myself in the place of the stories I always liked, and I always like adventures and whodunits and journeys and mysteries and all these things that people have to sort of work themselves out of.
I hear that, but I also recognize, having read your novels, that it's more than danger. There's a lot of violence, and there's a lot of, I think we were talking about this, unresolved violence.
Mm-hmm. Because violence is unresolved. I mean, I have, there a few things I'd say about violence, because I do have that reputation. I think, for one, there's a difference between preponderance and resonance. I think I usually give this totally wacko example of Led Zeppelin records, where, a Led Zeppelin album, when we think of Led Zeppelin, we think of the gold standard of hard rock.
Uh-huh.
And yet every Led Zeppelin album is 60% acoustic. So it's really just a folk rock album with some loud moments.
Wow.
But the loud tracks on that album rebound and echo and resonate so loudly and so completely that the whole album feels like it's that way. And I think when I write violence, violence has to reverberate. And also, the thing I find really interesting and interesting in a bad way with a lot of how particular cinematic violence works is that there's all this violence where there's no suffering. People suffer from that. And I think, for me at least, if I'm going to write about things like that, it has to be unflinching, just in the sense that violence comes with suffering, violence has consequences.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily that there is a preponderance, but I do believe it should resonate.
I was thinking about your description of the Led Zeppelin albums, and I was thinking those moments of quiet and the spaces. I mean, when I listen to Led Zeppelin, I also feel like I'm listening to what's happening in some of the spaces between the notes.
Yeah.
And they're ever sharper because we've hit the, you're right, because of the loudness, because of the cacophony of the 40% of, and maybe it's the same way in reading your novels.
I hope so. I think this is how you know, for me at least, when a writer has crossed the line. It's not just with violence. It's also with sex and all these things. If you start to feel numb.
Wow.
If it continues to horrify you, that's kind of, it's bad, but it's still within the realm of this is an experience that we're going through or we're experiencing. If it gets to the point where it's numb, then it has slid into pornography. And it can have a pornography of violence.
Right.
And I think that's the difference. If we're starting to get numb, then I think there's too much or it went too far or it's of a certain kind.
How do you preserve your own sensibility on that?
Oh, I have no sense. how do I, you know, I have to, for scenes like that, for really, really intense scenes, and I've written quite a few of those, I have to enter like a journalist. And I look at myself as a journalist for Imagine People. I have to, because otherwise I'm not going to get the full story. Or I'm going to get a skewed story, or I'm going to let my biases get in the way, or even my prejudices to get in the way. So I have to enter the scene like a reporter, and say as clearly and as definitively as possible what happened. But that's the only way, because I remember writing my second novel, which is about slavery, and a couple of points, I got so emotionally involved in it, because why wouldn't I? It's a horrendous story, and but it was hurting the book because one, I couldn't write these intense scenes with clarity. Two, I couldn't recognize the I'm going to say three dimensionality, although that's not a word, of the white characters. It'd be like slave good, master bad. And it's way more complicated than that. And I had to go back and recognize the complicatedness even in Despicable People. And the only way I was going to do that is to sort of put on my sort of reporter's cap and go in and get the story. And that is how, for me, I've navigated those spaces.
You trust your sensibility on that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very little, but some sort of journalist training. I mean, I did spend time in the newspaper and all of that. But I also just think that for me, most of my novels are told in first person. Most of my novels are driven by voice. So even if it's not a scene as intense, I still have to step back and let the character tell the story and let the character tell the story how they want to tell it.
You said a while ago that the way you write is meant to be read aloud.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to ask you to read an excerpt from this. But I am curious about the process of the reading aloud.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how does that work in the midst of the writing?
Sometimes I'll stop and read it out aloud. I think there are things that will miss your eyes that your ears will catch. And I always advise people to read their work alone. Or if you're a real glutton for punishment, have somebody read it to you.
Right. Does anybody do that with your work? Why?
You know, I mean, my skin is only that thick. not every novel or every story I've written, I've thought, this must be like an oral epic. But I do believe that novels should have volume. And I'm really impressed by novels that have volume control, that you can tell, you know, what is a secret being whispered to you and what is something that's being proclaimed. It's like reading Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon. You know the beginning is being proclaimed. Because everybody must look at this guy who's standing on the top of that hospital like he's going to jump or fly. It's like a town crier. But then when she gets into these secret family histories, it's almost a whisper. And I've always envied Toni Morrison for that, actually. More than anything else, her volume control. But I think novels should have that. I also think novels should smell. You know, they should smell and they should taste. They should they should have all those sensory elements.
You do have a lot of sensual description, but that is so interesting about the volume control.
Mm-hmm.
You've made me wonder as I'm reading with whatever voice is in my head, whether I am just naturally falling into those peaks and valleys of of volume.
I think you are with a good book, though. I think you know, a novel like, say, Jane Eyre, which is kind of being whispered to you.
One of my favorite, yeah.
It is. She clearly you're somebody she's taken into her confidence.
Right.
And that affects how you read it.
Long before you get to the reader I married in part.
And compare that to, say, Pride and Prejudice, where these are some big statements Jane Austen is making. And, you know, that is a novel that you're reading to the crowd. It's a truth universally acknowledged. And I think both of those writers were masters of volume.
You're listening to a conversation at the Fitzgerald Theater with writer Marlon James. His new novel is Black Leopard, Red Wolf, and I'm Carrie Miller. We mentioned that there is a sensuality to the writing. There's also some great sexy scenes and sexiness to the novel. And I think you've said that that is a reflection of the bodiness that you'll find in a lot of mythology, right?
Yeah, and you'll find in a lot of African mythology, certainly in the Greek.
Yeah.
God, I mean, I don't know how they ever got around to doing anything in Greek mythology. But you also find it's one of the things that also survived the slave ships here. If you listen to the blues is incredibly raunchy. As it should be. I mean, back in the early 20th century, you either sang in church or you sang the blues. So that kind of sexual frankness and that, even a sexual fluidity, you're still seeing the blues. I mean, a lot of those singers, Maureen and Bessie Smith, were singing about women.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of that sensuality, to, you know, for me, came from a lot of these African stories. And that was actually quite self-affirming for me.
How so?
Because I haven't been to Nigeria in a few years, but even when I was there, evangelical Christianity was really taking off, and there is this huge homophobia in countries like Uganda and so on, and it's easy to sort of drink the Kool-Aid about how these things happen. And when I was doing the research, and I came across things like the Shoga men, who everybody knew were gay because they were the only men trusted with brides to be. So I know I can have you guard my daughter because we and I both know nothing is going to happen. I can't bring my son here, but the daughter is fine. So clearly they knew. I remember when Chimamanda Adichie came to Makers and Queen, I interviewed her. And she was talking about how everybody knew about the two aunts at the end of the road. You know, everybody knew about the two uncles, who everybody knows are not uncles. And you knew that even if these people were never invited to, say, the party, everybody knew that were they to leave, the street, the village, the town would fall apart.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So there is always a space for that. There's always a space for fluidity. A lot of these traditions, you are born basically both sexes. Mind you, that also leads to horrendous things like circumcision.
But you find that again in Greek mythology.
Yeah, and there is all of that. There is, I mean, plural pronouns. I'm telling people, welcome to the party. We were there 4,000 years ago. But it was just, as a queer black person, it was really reaffirming. It was a joy to read that.
Is it a joy to write those kinds of sex scenes? Some writers are pretty uncomfortable with
that. Well, sex needs to be sexy, I think.
What makes sex sexy in literature?
I know what makes it non-sexy.
What makes it non-sexy?
Well, funny enough, one of the things that makes sex scenes non-sexy is classism. It's like when you watch even independent cinema, if the characters are working class, it's always super quick. Nobody's into it. They're really into the cigarette more. It's just sort of steeped and it's just coldly compulsive. And you'd never think that a huge portion of this world may actually enjoy sex. It's, you know, bricklayers get orgasms too.
There's a sentence I didn't think was going to happen in this conversation.
But it took me a while to realize just how classist the bad sex scene is, because too often we only see intimacy between people who have the leisure time. So people who are working two jobs don't have intimacy. Where did that come from? And I think the first thing in writing sex scenes is recognizing everybody has intimacy. And most people, for the part, kind of enjoy what they're doing. So that's why I think if violence should be violence, sex should be sexy. And it should be, to me, again, I think literary fiction authors are so afraid of overwriting.
Just in general, or sex?
Sex. I think they're afraid of overwriting.
Overwriting sex scene. Why?
Yeah. Or they feel they might slip into sentimentality or pornography. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to write those scenes, you have to risk both of those. But I also think you just, again, become a reporter. Okay, the world's kinkiest reporter. But become a reporter and report a scene. Say what happens and get out. It's... To me, it's the same principle in writing a sunset. I always tell my students, a sunset doesn't need your help. It's just say what it is. It's quite gorgeous on its own. And I think with any form of intimacy, it's not just sex. People have problems writing romance. And just write a love affair.
You know, we were downstairs, we were talking about how much Marlon loves Jackie Collins novels and how we both came to read Jackie Collins.
You're shocked.
My mother read Jackie Collins, and so I read Jackie Collins because I read whatever she read, and she didn't know that.
My mother read Your Day in Jesus. She's not reading that.
Right. But your housekeeper read Jackie Collins.
Housekeeper read Jackie Collins. And yeah, I remember reading Hollywood Wives, and it was the first novel I read in one sitting. And I think I was 13. And I finished it, and I thought, I'm an adult now.
Jackie Collins knew how to write sex scenes.
Oh, my God, yes.
Right?
But even I went, God, is everybody in this book going to have sex?
Really?
Yeah, but it's one of the reasons why I've never understood. This is one of the reasons I just don't get genre snobbery. Because that's not how I grew up. I grew up reading whatever book I could find, whatever people gave me, whatever I could afford, whatever I could steal. Okay, borrow and not return. Mm. Whatever book that was, it was all good. I'm like, okay, this is what I'm going to read next. And Jackie Collins was part of that. I mean, I quite enjoyed Harold Robbins.
I was going to say, I wondered if you read Harold
The Carpet
Robbins.
Baggers, oh my God.
How about The Betsy?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, was that sexy or what?
I remember, and what is it I read? Was it Jeffrey Archer's book, Cain and Abel?
Yeah.
Anything that became a miniseries, I probably read the book.
Thank God for that housekeeper.
Oh my God.
I mean, think about how limited your experience would have been.
I'm telling you, she read everything. Even these really ridiculous right-wing novels like The Executioner. It was The Executioner, The Penetrator, I don't know how that happened, The Destroyer, and one called The Butler. And I read all of them. I read pretty much everything. I'm amazed I'm not a right-wing maniac.
Do you still read prodigiously like that? Do you let
try.
Yeah.
I think I'm going good so far that I've read like four novels this year. Usually I'd have gone through four novels in a month.
But do you read outside of what you think is good for you? I mean, well, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. For me, I think it's all good for me, honestly. For example, I'm still a devoted reader of comics. It's funny, I was on Seth Meyers last week or the week before. And I think people think when the credits roll and we move in and talk, we're just moving our lips. He's like, have you read Hellboy in Hell yet? I'm like, oh my God, dude, it's a comic I've been waiting my life for. And he told me to read Black Hammer. I was telling him he needs to. And we both talk about, isn't it great that Saga will never be filmed? We had a total geek conversation. But I still read that. I read comics. If trust me, if Jackie Collins is coming to a book, I'm going to read it. I actually read Jodi Picoult.
Do you?
I do. She was shocked that I read her. I met her. And I was like, oh, my God, let's talk about when you did such and such in My Sister's Keeper. And she was like, you read that? I'm like, what am I going to read? I was like, you can't read Tolstoy every day.
That's right.
But, yeah, I just, you know, I remember I threw out a challenge a few years ago. I said, you know, you guys can knock chick lit all you want. It's the only genre where women work.
Wow, good point.
Because I don't know how people eat in these literary fiction novels.
Yeah.
I was like, when exactly did you earn the money for this piece?
Right.
I have bought Chardonnay. It's not cheap.
Right. Well. I think anybody who's been following the success of this, I hope, has read the news about Michael B. Jordan being attached to the movie.
Yeah. I love saying Killmonger bought the book.
I mean, wow. How'd you get the news on that?
Well, I mean, we've been talking for a while, actually. And before we even talked about deals, we just wanted to see if we liked each other.
Oh.
And if we're on the same page. And we really were.
Do you like him?
I quite like him. And I really did like Creed.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he's been in so many movies I like. Fruitvale Station, Black Panther, of course.
Right.
And just the whole, you know, the mission that him and his partners have about telling stories that aren't always told. And like one of the things we said, I said, you know, one of the issues I have when we talk about black people in the diaspora is that ground zero is always slavery. And I wrote a novel on slavery, and I am tired of it. That there is a pre-story, there's a prehistory. And there are all these great things that are out there, and I think can be the source of really fantastic cinema. And we were just talking about that for a while, and then we talked about business. But I was very impressed with him. I was very impressed with how smart he was, and how well read he was, and how much he seemed to be really, really into the book. He's one of those people who, I don't know, there was these mysterious leaks for this book that kept happening. And I kept going, I don't know what version of the book you have, but I don't think that character is in there anymore.
Where does something like that come from?
I have no idea.
Red herrings out there and they just to wind
that.
Us all up.
I'm going
to
do that.
Yeah.
I was at a party and somebody from FX came over and like, oh my God, I love your book so much. And I think we're going to make an offer. And I was like, this is what I'm going to do for you. I'm not going to tell anybody you just told me that you're reading a stolen copy of my book and you won't get fired. So
what will that experience be like? How much influence will you have on what happens in the actual movie making?
You know, I don't know yet. Usually they always float the idea of the novelist writing a screenplay. I think there are very few novelists who can write a screenplay.
Why?
And I'm not convinced that I'm one of them.
Why?
Because there is a certain kind of economy and there's a certain trusting of things to stage, managing, and dialogue, which a writer can easily just get away in metaphor and philosophy and blah, blah, blah. It's one of the reasons why I am so influenced by cinema, because you don't get to load, again, the sunset with metaphors. You just have to show it. And I think that kind of economy is hard for a novelist. I also think that writing a novel is such an individual, personal thing. I don't write by a committee. You're going to write a screenplay, particularly something like that is going to happen by a committee. And it's a different thing. It's not something I'm averse to. But I also have two more novels to write.
Right. So. Yeah, I have some left in the trilogy. You know, it's been interesting. There are some writers who've sat here and said, I let it go when the novel goes into movie or television production. Mm-hmm. I let it go and I'm fine with that. Mm-hmm. And others who have been crushingly disappointed in what gets done.
I don't think those two stories are all that separated. I think sometimes you do let it go and then you're crushingly disappointed.
Yeah.
And it could happen. I haven't decided yet how much of a role I want to play. I have no problem letting go either. But I am
really, why is that you have no problem letting go?
I think because I'm just so focused on the book, and I think that regardless of whatever happens to the film, the book is still the book. I like to think. But the thing is, I also am very interested in how a different artist interprets something I do. Like, I'm not so sort of, this must be this way. I actually am fascinated by that. I'm fascinated by how, you know, how somebody else reads and interprets it. If you know, if 100 people pick up this this book, Black Leopard, Red Wolf, that's 100 different worlds that have probably nothing in common floating out there in some sort of great universe. And I think that's fantastic. I love the Lord of the Rings films, but before Lord of the Rings, there must have been 10 million Frodos. Now there's only Elijah Wood.
That's why I'm curious about whether for you the movie is ever more fulfilling than the book. Not yours, in general.
Rarely, unless we're talking The Godfather or The Conformist. Sometimes I do think the movie is better. Rarely, but I do think sometimes the movie.
And why do you think that is?
Well, certainly in the case of The Godfather, there is a subtlety and ambiguity that's just not in the book. You think it would be the other way around.
It's pretty extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah. You think it would be the other way around, that would be the book that's loaded with ambiguity and the film that's too black and white. But it's the film that's loaded with it. But by and large, I do prefer the book to the movie. I mean, The Lover is a horrendous film. It's a great book. And, you know, Margaret Duras wrote the screenplay, so she knew it was horrible.
God, how does that happen?
She knew it. That's why she reissued the notes to the screenplay as another novel called The North China Lover. It's brilliant. I actually like it more than The Lover.
What are you reading right now?
Right now, I am reading... What am I reading? I'm reading Jane Eyre.
Oh, man, that is fantastic.
Yeah, I'm reading
Jane
Eyre. Why? Well, one, it was in the airport. and I also realized I have not read Jane Eyre in years. I have not read Jane Eyre since I was a teenager. And I've read White Tiger's Sea countless times since then, and it's of course it has recontextualized that novel for me, but I haven't gone back to it in a while, and I'm really excited to go back to it.
Okay, so what is the experience like? Who you are now? 25, 30 years later? To come back to it.
Well, I'm just starting it. It's Well, it's certainly easier to read now than then. It's interesting realizing again just how scandalous this novel was, you know, when it came out. People thought it was almost pornography. One of the most entertaining things about reading Jane Eyre is the introduction that Charlotte Brontë wrote for the new edition. And what did she say? It was actually, I can't remember. She says something really, really wise, though. She was talking about the sensationalism and the accusations that the book was filthy. And I can't remember what she said, but it was a really good line. But
exciting.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if I've been reading anything along with Jane Eyre. Oh, I'm also reading the Haunting of Hill House.
Why?
Because I saw the miniseries.
Ah.
And it's nothing like that. I also really love Shirley Jackson. I teach We've Always Lived in a Castle. Quite a bit. But I've never read Haunting of Hill House, so I'm reading those two.
I haven't either. So maybe I have to put it on the list.
It starts off pretty good. Sounds very 19th century, though. Yeah.
Should we open up to some questions?
Yes.
For a few minutes? Okay. We have a couple of microphones out in the audience. You can raise your hands to ask it right there in the middle.
Do you think of Donald Trump as sort of a modern African storyteller in terms of being a trickster? He's an unreliable narrator.
Uh-huh.
The story sort of loops on itself, like sometimes, and it's really hard to sort of have a sense what's going on.
I think there's a difference between a trickster and a liar. You know, Thomas Mallon answered this question way better once. I was on a panel, and somebody asked him, how would you write Donald Trump? And he's like, I have no idea. He's like the world's only living, breathing flat character. And you get the sense, even in a very quiet moment with his son, he's still that way. Yeah. I also think for the trickster to work, the trickster has to be a charmer. And I don't think he is remotely charming. I think a trickster is also a seducer. And these are all words that are totally foreign when we think of, Trump. And I also think a really good con, you actually sometimes appreciate the con. I was like, I see what you did. It's kind of smooth. You got me, but you're smooth. Whereas, I have to be careful how far I talk about Trump because my citizenship papers haven't come in yet. So I can, in this grace period, I can still be deported. So I'm going to...
For real?
Be, I don't real? Know. I don't trust anything. Ice might be outside.
Thomas Mallon writes great political fiction,
yeah,
doesn't he?
And
a
he
lot
really
of
does.
People don't.
Yeah. I haven't read Watergate yet, but he does. But
it's
then he's
be
in
so
it.
So good. What do you mean he's in it?
Well, I mean, he's in Washington a lot.
Oh, right.
Son, and I think he understands what the crime fiction writers also understand. You have to really dig deep.
Like Pelicanos.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay, question right over there.
So I really wish this was a question about like literature.
Mm-hmm.
But what
we can turn it.
What comics are you reading these days? And have you read the Flintstones' latest run and Snagglepuss's latest run?
I have not read those because I didn't know those were comics.
The Flintstones is possibly it is. Mm. It's like possibly the most socially aware comic I've read in the last 10 years.
It's got
gay couples. It's got PTSD.
Oh, my God. Stone Age gay couples. I love it.
Yeah, it's and the Snagglepuss one is about basically he's a gay writer during the 50s.
Oh.
And they're just absolutely phenomenal. But I'm just curious what...
I haven't come across those yet. For me, comics are literature. I think sometimes we worry that if we make them too highbrow, we lose what's essential about comics. And I understand that. That's something that happened with French comics for a little bit. But to me, the greatest American novel of the past 35 years is Palomar by Gilbert Hernandez. And I think Love and Rockets at any given time is the best fiction written ever, I think. And Palomar, to me, is up there at 100 Years of Solitude. It's out of print, so I think the more I shout about it, they'll bring it back in print. But Los Bros Hernandez, Palomar, Duck Feet, The Death of Speedy, those are phenomenal comics. I love Saga. I love Hellboy. I love Hellblazer. Lots of comics that begin with Hell.
It's the church coming out in
it's
you
a
again,
church,
right?
I'm telling you.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of comics, and I do think to me they are literature. I spend so much time with them. Oh.
Question right up there.
Yes.
Hi, I enjoyed the interview immensely, and I'm fascinated with what books, the literature you talk about. I wondered if you have read Clive Barker over the years or other.
I haven't read Clive Barker in years, but I did. I remember I used to read a lot of his stuff. I think the last thing I read was maybe Imagica, maybe. We're talking about seduction before, but really good horror. All good horror is a seduction. Someone, because they have to get you to the house on the hill in the first place. And I talk about that sometimes in my class about, genres, that the horror has to seduce you to scare you first. Dracula is scary, but he's also alluring. And I think that's something the torture porn people didn't understand. It's like, let me just gross you out. I was like, nah, that's not horror. That's just an atrocity exhibition. I haven't read him in a while, but I was a big devotee of Clive Barker.
Yeah, I think a lot of horror movies miss that too.
Yeah.
What you've just described.
Some of the more recent ones like Babadook, I think, are a little more. So I saw Babadook and I was like, okay, this is cool. It's fine. It's okay. It's good. I couldn't sleep for 3 weeks. I will turn off the light and there's a shadow on the ceiling. I'm like, oh dear God. And somebody's gonna knock
great.
3 times on my door and I'm gonna scream so loud.
That is really great.
Yes.
I was wondering what the creative process is when you allow the characters to take you places.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're still writing it.
Yeah.
But how does that happen? Is it like when a musician hears a song come into his head, or songwriter?
Sometimes it's like that. I still plot and overplot and write out what I want to happen in notebook after notebook after notebook. But I think sometimes I just do that to clear my head, because I will write, you know, copious bunches of notes and just not follow them, or just have them in the background somewhere. And sometimes I really do kind of just go, okay, where are we going to go today? And because I like to think that I write books the way I read books. And if it's something I've been thinking about too much, I usually don't write it. I've actually abandoned novels because I've thought about it too much. I remember I was going to write this novel, and I won't tell you what it is because you'll steal the idea. And I remember sitting down, and I sat down, and as I about to hit the keyboard, I went, I'm already bored. And so I saved that open-ended. Like, if Tuesday I know this character is going to turn left, wake up Wednesday morning, and I probably have them turning right. And so on. I think that also may be why my books are so long. But I you know, to me, it's like driving in is like driving at night, and you're going. You're not quite sure where you're going, but you kind of have an idea, and that opens up for surprise. Like, a good day for me is me going, I didn't see that coming. And if it's only going to be a surprise for the reader if it was a surprise for me when I was writing it. And that's the kind of principle I stick to. Yeah.
You know, you mentioned earlier that you someday may write a memoir, mm-hmm. about the experience with the church.
Yeah.
I mean, do you have this sense of, and I need to, live more to be ready? I mean, when does the moment write for?
That's a good question, because I really don't know. Because, I mean, I've been journaling since I was 16, and I have most of them.
Do you?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, those are terrible. Because at the time, I would journal in the style of the book I was reading. And I was reading Tom Jones a lot. So lots of Betwixt.
You're going to give those to a university at some point, right? McAllister's going to get those?
As long as they're sealed. I don't know. I think, I think I'll know. Because I've known people who have waited till they're 60. And I've known people who have published, 22. And
right.
Both have come at the right time. So I think it really depends on when I feel, I feel ready. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Could you speak to the sort of passage of time in this novel?
Mm-hmm.
As I'm reading it, it feels like there's kind of a dreaminess to it.
Yeah.
There's no sort of sense of it, right?
Like, yeah. It's funny because I actually have a calendar in my notes and I know exactly how many days pass between each thing. I needed to know that so I don't get confused writing it. I wasn't going to make you know it because it should pass in a kind of a fever dream. There is some linearity to it, that there is a beginning and a middle and an end. But part of it, too, is Tracker is telling a lot of stories and stories about stories. And those are outside of time quite a bit. I also wanted people to, certainly by halfway through the book, let go of the sort of Western expectations of story that they may still have. And why wouldn't they? I have them. But I actually believe what, Margaret Atwood said once, that wasn't Margaret, it was A.S. Byatt, who said that sometimes novels also teach you how to read them. And I think certainly with this novel, because it's going in such a foreign world, I think that hopefully eventually the reader latches on how to read it. And sort of a beginning, middle, end is not necessarily the best way, I think. And the trilogy itself also works that way, because it's not a part one, part two, part three. It's three different characters telling basically the same story. So, part two is also what happened to this kid. It's just that their stories won't add up at all, as witness testimonies sometimes tend to go. Yeah.
How many of Margaret Atwood's novels have you read?
Jesus, how many have I read? Maybe around six?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
You excited about The Testament?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure yet. It's
do we need to know the
It's
sequel?
Always tricky when a novelist revisits territory. Especially for a novel that I think One of the really, really important things about Handmaid's Tale is the novel that you continue in your mind.
Right.
So,
although television has kind of ruined that for us, if you've watched the
series. Well, I haven't watched it, so.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's still pure and true in my head.
But, I mean, and it's really, really good, but mm-hmm. it completely took over
yeah.
the novel in my head about where that novel went.
Yeah, I wonder if that also happened with Alias Grace.
Yeah.
Which may be, it's certainly one of my favorite of her novels.
Right.
But my favorite of hers is still Cat's Eye.
Ah, not Handmaids.
No. In a, yeah, that was always been Cat's Eye. Hmm. Yeah.
So you mentioned that you did The Moth on this stage. Mm-hmm. I believe it was shortly after Brief History came out.
Yeah.
And lots happened since then. So
a little bit.
You know, I was curious, you know, as you think back to that time, did you think, wow, Brief History is great. I bet it's going to win the Man Booker Prize. Or, you know, what's your life like now versus then?
Well, I was just hoping my publisher would spend some money and enter the book. And I also didn't think I was going to win. I really thought Hanya was going to win. I mean, she was certainly the favorite to win, and I was already congratulating her. It was funny because this is a quick story. So at the Booker Prize, a good third of the people in the room already know who won. Hmm. Almost all the media in the room already knows. So you can usually tell who won by the number of people trying to sneak over to the table and not making it seem that way, so they can take a quick picture of you when you win. So the journalist at my table already knew, and she, at one point she just couldn't handle it anymore. She was like, "Have you written an acceptance speech?" I'm like, "Nah," and she's like, "I really think you should write an acceptance speech." I was like, I don't think so. I have a list of people to thank, but, and she's like, "Listen, I really think you should write." And I didn't pick up on it. And she got so, at one point she just looked at my publisher and went, "He won, you know." And my publisher says, "Well, that's what we all want, dear." nobody was believing her. So there's that. How has it changed everything? You know, it's you know, one of the great things about living here is that people are just so unfazed. I still have my same office, the same place, and the people downstairs still won't turn off the heat. And I'm burning up in my damn office. And my students always like to say, "My mom loves your book." So I have a lot of normalizing sort of influences all around.
You know, one of your former students is sitting right back there. Yeah. And you know what he said to me before? There he is.
Alex.
He said, Marlon, God, what you said.
If you embarrass me, you will die.
Hi, Marlon.
Hey.
I'm sitting here with another McAllister student, and we were talking a little bit about how, you know, I had a lot of classes for you throughout the years, and you'd bring up recurring themes or jokes such as, because you worked in the media industry, you knew which rappers were gay, but you weren't going to tell us. So I was hoping some of those would come back up.
Alex, no, you were like, he had 16 jokes. And I said, I guarantee you he will not tell those 16 jokes.
I'm pretty
in this
sure
interview.
It was not 16 jokes. I had like six.
Right. Did
and
he?
If you took enough, yeah, and if you took enough classes with me, you heard the same ones over.
That's what he said.
That's what I'm saying.
And you heard the same ones
But that
over
didn't
and
happen
over.
Tonight, did it?
No, I'm a little disappointed. You only used like one of them.
All right, good. We're plowing new territory here,
I'm
Alex.
Like,
that's
you know,
what it's all about.
I have a brand new dress on. I'm like,
it's all new. Okay, a couple more questions because he's going to do a signing. Yeah.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my question. I'm also Jamaican. I moved up here for university, and I've been here ever since a couple of decades ago.
One of those people.
Yes, one of those people. I find that as I live here in the States longer and longer, I'm simultaneously intensely proud of Jamaica and love the history and, you know, love to talk about Nanny of the Maroons and these great stories of Jamaica. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, it's kind of complicated because I find I'm ideologically out of step with how I was raised
right
in Jamaica. I wonder if you also, living here, meditate on that kind of complicated relationship you may have, and if so, if it factors in your writing.
What a great question.
Yeah, not only is it complicated, there are complications on the complication. Because I used to have, one of the things I have found just in the last few trips is something that even contradicts what you just said, where I have found that there are way more open and open-minded people in the country and way more closed-minded people in the diaspora. Like, I will find, for example, way more Jamaicans who are so past me being gay in Jamaica, which shocks me. But there's still Jamaicans in the diaspora who won't talk to me. And so it's I've actually found that people on the rock tend to be evolving, while sometimes people here are stuck where, at the point where they left. So it's complicated, because I would never have said that 2 years ago. So even then, but it's still a complicated relationship. But I remember, I went to Jamaica. I mean, I'm there all the time. I was there January 2016, and I met the Queer Students Association at University of West Indies. I'm shocked there was one, and I had my "It Gets Better" speech ready, and I was going to talk about it. And they're like, "We don't want to hear that shit." They're like, "Do you know Beyonce?" I don't. And suddenly I felt very inadequate. But I also realized it was a generation of queer Jamaicans who refused to give up their youth. They're like, "No, I want to think about music, and I want to think about Rihanna. I don't want to think about survival or so on." And that was very bracing and very, it was shocking for me and wonderful. So it's complicated. At the same time, I wouldn't live in Jamaica because there are things I do absent-minded, like hold a guy's hand without thinking about it. I don't want to go back to having to think about it. I don't want to go back to being deliberate in how I express myself. So it's, you're right, it's complicated and it will always be complicated. Is it in the book? It's certainly in Brief History quite a bit. With a character like Weeper, on one hand, I was reading Margaret Duras when I wrote Weeper. And Margaret Duras, her novel, The Nart Channel, of which I mentioned before, yeah, reads like stage direction, which it actually was. And it hit me, a guy who's in the closet probably stage manages even a hookup. He would stage manage everything. He would know how far away people are. He would know how far away are the people who can hear me and how quiet I should be. And it made me think again, being a Jamaican and being in the diaspora and being away from safe space, how uncomfortable it would always be negotiating that space. So I think that that is in the book, and that is very much reflective of my discomfort. But it's also the loosest and freest prose in the book, I think, and that also reflects me being sort of looser and freer in ways that I sometimes feel I have to tone down when I go back. Because I like to think I was super butch. And I go to Jamaica and they're like, "Dude, you have to let go of some of that. You're too free." I'm like, "What are you talking about? I'm like a hardcore jock gay." People still think I'm straight. Like, nobody here. Like, okay.
Oh, my gosh. I know we have to get to the book signing. This has been so fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
So much.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.